WNYC Studios is supported by MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Did you catch the Great American Eclipse? After months and years of preparation and excitement, it's unfortunately over. What you're left with is not only a memory of a life-changing event, but also those funny eclipse glasses. How many did you have, right? If you're like me, you're wondering what to do with them now. Maggie Kurth-Baker, senior science writer at 538, is here to tell you why you shouldn't just throw them away, all part of her selected short subjects in science. Welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Did you get to see the eclipse?
Oh my gosh, I did. I went down to Lincoln and it was an intense experience. You know, people were hugging, people were crying, people down the street were applauding the sun. It was just, I'm so glad I drove all the way to Nebraska.
It was great. I got to see from Casper and it was better than anything I could have thought. And we're going to actually have a little bit of an eclipse from four time zones later on in the program. So stay tuned for that.
Oh, wow.
Let's talk about, so what do we do? Should we hang on to the glasses for the next 7 years?
Well, the advice is that you don't, because once you leave them in a drawer for 7 years, they're probably going to get scratched up and then they won't be protective anymore. But there is a good solution for what to do with them. You know, my friend's mom had dozens of these things, and you can actually donate them. So there's a group called Astronomers Without Borders that has a website where you can go to send your glasses in, and they're collecting them for these schools in South America and Asia where there's going to be an eclipse in 2019.
Ooh, I'm writing that down right now, both to send them and to go to the next one, if I could. Okay, let's talk about new statistics about drug abuse and a group you might not expect.
Yeah, the British Medical Journal came out this week with an editorial that's building on this longer, older story about the elderly and drug and alcohol abuse. So the editorial cited these really shocking statistics from Australia and the UK, like the fact that drinking is declining in those places, except among people 50 and over, and that the largest percentage increase in drug abuse in the last 3 years has been in this 60-plus age group. But you see similar patterns in Asian countries, you see similar patterns in the U.S., and here the number of retirees in substance treatment is expected to triple by 2020.
So it's basically the baby boomers we're talking about here.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff about statistics have been gathered, I guess, over the last 10 years about this. So, like, back in 2015, the news site The Fix found that the rate of illicit drug use for baby boomers had been going up over the previous decade, while the rates for teenagers had been declining. So there's some evidence even that baby boomers are gravitating more towards drug and alcohol abuse than young people are.
And do we have an idea why this is?
We don't have a whole lot of ideas why, but it's part of this longer trend with the generation. So baby boomers have had very high usage rates for alcohol and drugs, higher than a lot of other generations at the same age rate, rather at the same age. And it's just kind of this ongoing trend for that generation. And then in addition to that, you have things like you're getting older, you get prescribed pain relief for various kinds of ailments. So that gets kind of wrapped into the problem as well.
Well, wrapped into the problem, I might ask, is the opioid epidemic?
Yeah. They're finding things like people between the ages of 45 and 64 had the highest rate of inpatient hospital stays for opioid abuse. And if you look back 20 years ago, it was younger people, so between the ages of 25 and 44.
Let's move on to another controversial story. You will have an interesting story about a lawsuit connecting baby powder and ovarian cancer.
Right. So this was connected in a lawsuit and more tenuously connected in science, which I think is the really interesting part about this. A woman won a $400 million lawsuit alleging that baby powder use regularly in her underwear gave her ovarian cancer. And there is hypothetical reason why you might make a connection between those two things. In this case, the idea is that if you are using this in your underwear on a daily basis, you might have these particles of talc sort of traveling up and causing inflammation in your reproductive tract, which can lead to cancer cells. And you also have some population studies suggesting a correlation between cancer and baby powder exposure. But those studies are also really inconsistent, and other studies have found no correlation. And so some people are going to come away from that data set saying, oh, this is a big problem. And others are going to say, that's probably fine. And both have the evidence to prove their point. And that's true of exposures of lots of different things that we come into contact with on a daily basis, from deodorant to plastics to makeup. So I think what's really interesting about this is that the legal case doesn't actually prove one way or the other whether baby powder is dangerous. What it proves is that Americans really think differently about risk assessment in a courtroom than they do in the grocery store.
Because we take risks every day.
And right. Yeah. Every single day.
Yeah. That's interesting. I guess we'll have to just wait for more studies to come out about this, the science behind it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to your last story. We have new evidence for, this is interesting, for I'm sure I'm reading this correctly, diamonds raining on Neptune and Uranus. Can we
it's
get a trip out
there?
It's a
great time to be alive. So back in 1999, these scientists came up with this crazy idea that maybe diamonds were raining from the sky on Neptune and Uranus. And that was just based purely on kind of chemistry. You know, you've got hydrocarbons, you've got the right temperatures, you've got the right pressures. Maybe it could be happening. And then they just published some data from an experiment demonstrating that this actually is possible. So these scientists got polystyrene, which they chose because its chemistry kind of mimics the methane interior of these planets. And they shot it with lasers, which is great. And in doing so, they created a couple of shock waves that sort of simulated the temperatures and pressures you'd find on these planets. And when the shock waves crashed into each other, you got tiny, tiny little nanometer-wide diamonds.
Where do I get that kit from to get styrofoam? So basically styrofoam and a laser, and we make diamonds.
Yeah, it's great. It'll be fine. So what I think is pretty cool about this is that the researchers said that, down deep on these planets, there might actually be huge diamonds. And that's just speculation. There's no real way to know for sure. But I think it's really kind of cool that we are able to take this data that we know about planets, things like atmospheric content, heat and pressure, and actually use an experiment to help us understand what the experience of that place that we can never really know could be like.
And now we know why venture capitalists will be investing and going to these places. We don't have to worry about NASA or anybody
yes,
going.
Yes, Elon Musk is taking notes right now.
All right, Maggie. Thanks again. Maggie Kurth-Baker, senior science writer at 538 in Minneapolis. So good to have you again.
Thanks a lot.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every side has a flip side. Every story does. Not long ago, the most popular explanation for any dangerous teenage behavior was what? Remember? Raging hormones. Fast forward a few years and the explanation changed. The teenage brain is actually biologically different. Teens' prefrontal cortex is less developed than an adult's. Remember that one? Yeah, well, that's kind of current. But a new study from the University of Pennsylvania suggests your teen's bad decisions are driven by something else entirely. And here to give us the good and the bad when it comes to the teenage brain is my guest, one of our own, very own producers, Katie Heiler. Welcome to Science Friday. Welcome. Your first time on the air.
Yes. Hi, Ira.
So the current theory is that teenage brain is still developing, and that's why they make bad decisions.
Right. So the research out there right now on teenage brains suggests that the prefrontal cortex, the decision-making center, is still developing up until age 25 or so. It's sort of the last part of the brain to fully develop. So that creates an imbalance between the decision-making center and the regions that are in charge of motivation and reward that have kind of already matured. And researchers have used this to explain why teens have poor impulse control or why they take risks that adults probably wouldn't. The reward center is kind of motivating the teen, and then the prefrontal cortex just isn't prepared to kind of put the brakes on that.
But you're here to tell us that this might not be true now.
Right. So Dr. Dan Romer and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, they took a look at the research and they didn't really see sufficient evidence for this association in the literature. They say, yes, the brain's not fully developed in teens, but that's not the problem behind bad decision making. He says most teens actually aren't impulsive. They're sort of hyper-rational. The risky behavior is a choice teens are making that's driven by a desire to explore the risk in favor of gaining experience. So it's not a structural deficit that's causing this, and that's a good thing.
So this is just like an experience gaining. That's what they're doing, this stuff, just to gain the experience of the experience.
Right, exactly.
And so, but okay, it's a great new hypothesis. What's the science? What's the data? How do we know it's really, you know, that this need for experience that's driving these choices?
Right. So for one thing, Dr. Romer points out that if it's biology, then more teens would probably have this problem. But if you look at the population, really, only a handful of teens are making the impulsive decision to drink and drive, let's say, or have unprotected sex. That really should be a higher prevalence if it's based in, you know, this biology. And if there were an imbalance that was the issue, then you'd also expect these teens to be worse at controlling their urges than kids. And that's not actually the case. You know, Ira, that classic marshmallow experiment with kids where you give the kid one marshmallow right now, or they can wait and have two later.
Right,
you know, kids are really bad at that. But in sort of the teenage version, which is, you know, you can have $2 now, or there's a 50-50 chance you can get $4 later or nothing. You know, teens are better at weighing the decision, you know, weighing the choices in that case. So in studies, when the probability of an outcome is clearly laid out for the teen, you know, a chance of a reward or risk of a punishment, they're able to use the information to make a successful decision.
So what's the bad news? Any bad news in this thing?
Well, the bad news is just that teens are still going to be risky, even if it's not because of this prefrontal cortex, you know, being underdeveloped. They're still going to make risky decisions. And that's especially the case when teens don't have that information that I was just mentioning available to them. When they're making a decision under ambiguous circumstances, they're going to be more risky than adults because they're going to want that experience.
Teens are going to be teens.
That's true.
Thank you, Katie. Katie Heiler, Science Friday's assistant producer. Up next, Voyager gave us never-before-seen looks at the outer planets, and now it's in its 40th year. Can you believe that? Gosh, in 1989, I was watching Neptune all night when Voyager was going by. It's exploring space beyond the solar system. It is the farthest man-made object. We're going to talk about it right after this break.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you think of NASA's Voyager mission, you may first think of the golden record. Do you remember that phonograph recording being carried to tell alien agencies who and where we are? Or you may think of the 1990 portrait Voyager 1 shot of our entire solar system, on which Carl Sagan famously opined,
"On that blue dot, that's where everyone you know and everyone you ever heard of and every human being who ever lived out their lives. It's a very small stage in a great cosmic arena."
But Voyager also brought us the first close-up views of Uranus and Neptune, showed us spoke features in the rings of Saturn, and details of Jupiter's storm that we had never seen before and never imagined. Voyager imaged Io's volcanic plumes, the potential for life on Enceladus and Titan. And Voyager is turning 40 this year. Yeah, and there are actually two Voyager spacecraft. Voyager 2 launched on August 20th, 1977. Voyager 1 closely behind it on September 5th. And Voyager 1 is the most distant man-made object from Earth. 8-track tape recorder on it and all. Here to look back with us on four decades is Carolyn Porco, planetary scientist, former member of the Voyager imaging team. She joins us she's been on our show a number of times. Welcome to Science Friday. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I have to say, for starters, that I can't believe we got everything we did from Voyager. And those crafts are recording on 8-track tape. Doesn't it blow your mind?
Yes, it does blow my mind. And so for me, the best thing about this anniversary and the celebration that everyone seems to be making of it is just to have the opportunity to spend some time remembering what we all accomplished so long ago with so very little.
Well, let's talk about that. Set the scene for us. What did we know about the outer planets at that time when Voyager was conceived and launched, and what did we learn?
Well, we knew, as I just said, we knew very little, and that's what's just so remarkable to me to remember. We even knew very little about Jupiter and Saturn. I mean, we didn't know how they were structured. Rotation rates, at least for Saturn, were not clear. Composition was an entirely different matter. We knew nothing about what we were eventually going to find in the rings of Saturn. And then as far as Uranus and Neptune go, that was the hinterlands. Even in the most powerful telescopes on the Earth, they were just these fuzzy little dots, or at most a little blob of blue, and not much else is known. Maybe we knew a moon or two. So it was really venturing into uncharted territories. And this is what is so monumental about what Voyager did. Most of the solar system, and it doesn't matter how you measure it, if you count the number of bodies or you measure the amount of mass that is contained in those bodies, most of our solar system, the vast majority of it, exists beyond the orbits of the asteroids. And where we live, the Earth, along with Venus and Mars and Mercury, our neighbors, there's virtually nothing here. We're nestled in close to the sun, but our solar system exists out there. And we could not have claimed to know what our own solar system was like until we had a mission that toured the outer solar system in the way that Voyager did. And so it opened up, it blew the doors off the house and opened up the view of our solar system for our investigation and understanding.
There are so many little side stories about this mission. I want you to tell us one of the original side stories, which is it almost didn't get funding to go as far as it went, did it?
Oh, no, and it's a wonderful side story, because it's got a little bit of subversion in it, which I don't know appeals to my subversive spirit maybe, but the funding was only provided to go to Jupiter and Saturn, but the engineers kind of winked at each other and said, oh yeah, we'll show them, and they designed it so that it could, if given an extension, the mission could go to Uranus and Neptune. So whenever there was a decision to be made, are we going to build this instrument with the capability to last up until Saturn encounter, or are we going to give it the extra, you know, whatever it needs in order to last as far as Neptune? Well, they chose the latter. And, of course, we are all the very, very much better for it.
Hmm. You know, I followed this mission closely. I remember being at JPL when it flew by the rings of Saturn. I think it was a Saturday night, I remember, about midnight. And I remember there was something wrong with one of the arms on it at the time. There was a little hiccup on it. But we knew almost nothing about those rings when we first launched Voyager. And I remember the amazing amount of new information, the stunning close-ups, the spokes, the little maybe moons in the rings, just amazing stuff that we learned about Saturn's rings.
Oh, Saturn's rings were one of the stars of the Saturn encounter, because that was, I mean, whoa, just being confronted with that and seeing all the complexity in the rings was so mind-blowing. And I was lucky, because there was so many new discoveries in the rings that two very important topics fell to me, a graduate student, to work on for my doctoral dissertation. And that kind of, you know, defined what I would do for the rest of my life, because I ended up studying the very type of rings that were found in the late 70s encircling Uranus. So when Saturn encounter was over, when I finished my PhD thesis, I was added officially to the Voyager imaging team to help plan the Uranus and Neptune encounters because I had the domain knowledge that was required for studying the Uranian rings. So the Saturnian ring system has a, you know, very, I have a very soft spot in my heart for it. But then, of course, there was Titan, which was a big, just such an interesting body, and we never got to see the surface of Titan like we had hoped with Voyager, and that was left for Cassini to do.
And of course, how do you decide which moons of all those the giant gas giants to look at? How do you know which ones to choose?
Well, remember when we first got there with Voyager 1, we didn't know about all the moons. We only knew about, you know, a handful of them. And important ones were the important targets for the Voyager 1 flyby were the rings, the atmosphere, of course. That's the globe of Saturn itself. That's always the case. But the other targets would be Titan, as I just said, was a major, great anticipation about what we would find on Titan. And then the rings. And then since the Voyager 1 mission was successful, what they decided to do with Voyager 2 was pay more attention to the other moons, the other major moons, and they found others in the process. And especially at Uranus and Neptune, it's very hard to see the moons, especially when it's even challenging to see the planet itself. We found lots of moons. So, you know, I mean, I could go into lots of detail about how Voyager, their programming of it got to be so sophisticated that we were able to plan ahead, leave a space in our imaging sequences, leave an empty space so that when we got there, if there was a new moon and we had a target to it, we'd have the opportunity to do it. Things like that happened.
And, of course, that sort of set the stage for us realizing that the moons out there could be as important to explore as any of the planets because they might harbor life in them.
Yes, well, they certainly, we found that they could harbor oceans. And then subsequent missions like Galileo at Jupiter and, of course, Cassini at Saturn found that there are moons around each body, each planet, that do have subsurface oceans. I mean, we know for sure they have subsurface oceans now. And with Enceladus, the small moon that has a subsurface ocean at Saturn, we even know that it has all the basic ingredients for what we call in our business a habitable zone. It checks all the boxes for a body of water that we want to go back to and investigate further because it could. We're not saying it does, but it could possibly harbor life. So it has, I mean, again, our explorations of our solar system have really not only given us a perspective on ourselves and our cosmic place, but they have shown us how limited our thinking is until we go traveling. You know, Rudyard Kipling, I believe, was the one who said travel can be mind-expanding, and our explorations of our solar system have certainly shown that to be the case.
And so which moon would you like to go back to if you could just wave your magic wand?
I would go back to Enceladus. I made a big deal over the last 10 years since we have found this geysering basin at the South Pole that Cassini has flown through, and we've grabbed samples of this material, and we've analyzed it, and we know it has organic compounds. It's coming from an ocean, a salty ocean with salinity comparable to our Earth's oceans. It has simple organic compounds, even evidence for hydrothermal activity on the seafloor. I mean, it's got everything you could possibly want at this point in time to make a decision about what's the best place to go. We now know Enceladus is the best place to go.
So are we going?
Well, there are two groups that have proposals that they have submitted to NASA for NASA's New Frontiers program. That should be decided by the end of this year. That's two proposals to Enceladus out of 12, so it's not clear at all that those proposals will be selected. But, in fact, you've given me the opportunity to say that there's a documentary that has aired and it will air again on September 13th, I believe it is, at 10 o'clock p.m. on PBS. It's called The Farthest, and it celebrates what Voyager accomplished. But immediately after that, there's a mini documentary called Second Genesis, and I am the subject and the guide in this documentary, and I go through It's kind of about my quest to go back to Enceladus to search for life. So I hope everybody watches that.
So you're sort of the new Carl Sagan.
Oh, I think there's many that probably would qualify for that, but I appreciate the compliment.
So is there still a mission left for the Voyager spacecraft? I mean, are they going to run out of fuel? How far can they go? What do they do out there now?
Well, you know, in my mind, the Voyager mission is the Apollo 11 of the planetary exploration program. It has earned that stature, that iconic stature in our culture, because not only, as I just said, did it open up the solar system for our view, but it carried with it a record of human greetings and songs and pictures of our planet that constitute a message from humanity to the Milky Way, to whatever, whoever finds Voyager, if ever, they will know by looking at not only the construction of the spacecraft, but this record, that there was an intelligent civilization that put this together and sent it on its way. And it was sent across space into the future, and it will very likely live for billions of years. It could do that. Certainly the Voyager record could do that. And in some sense, it is the closest that we, humanity, will ever come to immortality. And people immediately registered with that. They, you know, it moved people, it stirred people in such a way that Voyager has become people have such a fond feeling for this mission. Mm-hmm. And in August of 2012, Voyager 1 finally entered interstellar space. And so Voyager defined us. It defined us as an interplanetary species during the 1980s, and now it has defined us as an interstellar species. And so it will continue. That will be its mission. In about 10 years, between 2 and 10 years, depending how the power is on the spacecraft is managed, it could last another 10 years. And then it will wink off. It will have no more power to send us any signals. It will be an enormously sad moment in history when that happens. But Voyager will continue long, long after. Could be long after humanity is gone. And here's another crazy thought that one of the producers of the Voyager record, in fact, brought up. His name is Timothy Ferris. Perhaps billions of years from now, Voyager could be found, the record might be found, and it could be found by a civilization that hasn't even evolved yet.
Wow.
So we have touched, it's like knocking on eternity's door. That's what Voyager has done for us.
Carolyn Porco is my guest this hour on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Well, that's just, you know, and it's still functioning out there in interstellar space, sending stuff back. How long does it take the signal? It's like an 8-watt transmitter or something, isn't it? I mean, how long does it take the signal to get there? Can we still hear it?
I think by the time, I just read myself, by the time it gets to us, it's some 16 trillionth of a watt. So, you know, they're listening very closely, let's put it that way. But it's something like 16 or 17 hours of light travel time, meaning light, the fastest thing that we know. And as far as we know, the fastest thing possible takes 16 or 17 hours to get to us from Voyager.
Wow.
It's very far away and increasing.
But you know, you make it a good point about it entering our psyche and our culture. I mean, even one of the Star Trek movies had it as a gotcha at the end of the movie, if you remember.
I remember that so well, and I remember when it got to the end, and I realized anyway, V'ger was actually the Voyager spacecraft. I think I was jumping up and down. I was so happy.
And we don't make them like this anymore, do we?
Oh, no, that's not true. We do make them. We make them pretty good. Cassini has been a monumental mission. It's technologically so much more advanced over what Voyager was.
But Cassini's the last one, isn't it, of that kind of spacecraft?
Cassini is the mission that we put in orbit around Saturn. And I don't know when we'll see a mission that's that huge. Again,
right.
It carried 12 instruments, and it also carried a probe that was deployed to enter this Titan atmosphere and land on its surface that was landfall in the outer solar system. Cassini has accomplished so much, and we are about to bid that spacecraft goodbye to. In September 15th, Cassini will be sent into Saturn, and a 27-year mission, 20 years in flight, and 13-plus years at Saturn will come to an end.
Well, we'll be saying goodbye to that also. It is emotional. It's an emotional...
It is, especially if you've been involved and you've devoted your life to missions like this. It's really, for me, it's kind of the end of my career as a planetary explorer. I'll be involved in other missions in a small way, but I'll never be, I'll never take on the kind of job that I've had on these two. And I'm so proud of what we've all done, and I feel like I've led a charmed existence.
Well, we thank you for all these years that you've joined us to talk about Voyager, Cassini, and we wish you, you know, finding interesting new stuff to work on. Carolyn Porco, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, if you're thinking of showering alone, we've got news about millions of microbes. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We talk a lot about the microbiome of our gut, the trillions of bacteria, viruses, fungi living inside of us that may influence our health and happiness. At the same time, there's a world of microbes outside our bodies that we're perhaps less familiar with. Even though they sleep with us, they shower with us, they eat with us, they live with us in our offices and homes, the microbiomes of where we live and work. These organisms thrive indoors despite our best efforts to keep them out, and they can affect our health in ways scientists aren't yet clear about. So recently, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Mathematics published a report that included questions researchers still want answers to, including, which microbial community should we treat as unwanted guests, and which do we welcome in with open arms, literally? And how do we build living spaces that promote a healthy indoor microbiome? Joining me to discuss these questions are my guests, Jessica Green, professor of biology at Oregon State University and CTO of Phylogen. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Nice to have you. Rob Dunn, professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University and author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, it's great to be on. Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Rob, this idea that there are microbes in your home, it's really not surprising to anyone, but we don't like to think about it. You know, if we're looking to go where should we find some of these communities in our homes?
Well, I mean, sort of everywhere. I mean, they're divided up, you know, and so every place you lie down or sit down or go to the bathroom or eat something, there's kind of an aura of you. But then if you look around in more detail, there are these smaller habitats that have specialized microbes, like in your sourdough bread or in your beer or in your cheese. And so it's a very complex ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You right now.
Are any of them in our homes particularly harmful that we bump into every day?
Sure. There are definitely species that can be harmful. Far fewer than there would have been in your home in 1800 in London, say. But I think what's more conspicuous than the harmful species that are present is how many species that we used to be exposed to in our homes that are now missing. And so in a way, like the homes we've created today, they aren't marked so much by what's there as by what's absent in a lot of ways.
Dr. Green, forgive me for saying Oregon State University. I know it's University of Oregon, and I will get whipped for that later on.
Not a problem.
Let me ask you about the researchers. A bunch of them got together to author this report. What conclusions did they come to about the indoor microbiome?
Well, it was a fantastic group. It was a pleasure to serve on the committee. And the committee decided that the agenda for the future was to really develop a microbiome-informed built environment that both considered occupant health and energy efficiency. And the committee outlined the what, the why, and the how to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. I was watching a TED talk you gave describing how a building, you picked out a building and showed that in this office space, there could be all different kinds of microbiomes depending on where the office was located, where the air ducts were. And I guess the point being there's not just one microbiome in any place.
Absolutely. So what's incredible is that engineers and architects, without realizing it, and even ordinary people in the home without realizing it through our behavior, we impact these microbial ecosystems that Rob referred to, and we're just beginning to understand how we can manage indoor ecosystems. And what the committee identified was a key component of this is being able to measure what we're exposed to in the indoor environment and these complex ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. And Rob, that's what you do? You measure what's living in our homes?
Yeah, so we've spent a lot of time sort of doing the Alexander von Humboldt approach to exploring houses, and so really trying to figure out what's in houses. And so we surveyed the dust in a thousand houses across North America, and now with Noah Fuhrer working on shower heads and sourdough bread, as Jessica points out, there's tons to understand, and so part of what needs done now is just to figure out what's there in the first place. And it makes it very, very fun from an exploration perspective. It's also daunting because we realize that as we explore what's in homes, these species also have health and well-being consequences. And so, fun because every corner yields some totally new discovery, disappointing because we can't always say what that means for what you should do next.
I was on your website and I saw that you had a project about shower heads. And tell us about, when you take a shower, you're not showering alone, are you?
Well, yeah, the shower heads full of these crazy little biofilms, which are like a house that the microbes build for themselves and others. And in those biofilms, we know that sometimes there are species that can cause problems, especially if you're immunocompromised, which lots of people are now. But then also species that look like they're probably beneficial, that they're triggering positive immune responses in you. And so like what's falling on you into your eyes, into your mouth, it's almost definitely affecting you in some way, but we don't have a very good understanding of, what determines which species are in your shower head versus your neighbor's shower head versus the hotel shower head. We have a survey around the world with Noah Fuhrer to try to figure out what's in there, what it's doing.
Hmm. I understand you also think that the kitchen's dishwasher is an interesting place to put it, euphemistically.
Yeah, that's not our work, but people have shown that in the soap dish in the dishwasher, there's a pretty gnarly fungus. And it seems to really like conditions that are dry and then wet and then soapy and then not soapy. But it's also very unusual because we know it's present in dishwashers, and then it's also present in the feces of tropical fruit bats. And I think that's sort of indicative of like where we are in understanding, because clearly there's some connection between those two. We haven't sampled where else it might live or what else it's doing. But the cool part about that is a lot of these species we find in weird habitats and houses, they can be really useful still. And so, think about your bread mold that yields antibiotics. We work on camel crickets in people's basements, and we found new bacteria that can turn industrial waste into energy from those. And so, on the one hand, I wish that I knew what was going on with that thing in the dishwasher. On the other hand, once we find it, we can make use of it, too.
Mm-hmm. Jessica, I can imagine that, we've heard about the microbes running around in hospitals. We don't want certain microbes infecting our patients. But how much do we want a completely sterile environment? Where is the trade-off? What is the perfect situation?
That's a great question. I just ran into Bill Nazaroff here on the Cal campus, UC Berkeley, when I took classes from him about 2 decades ago on indoor air quality. The thesis was that you want to keep microbes out of the indoor environment and that microbes were pollutants. But we now really understand that, just like Rob said, there are good actors and bad actors in the indoor environment. And what we want to do is, again, manage the indoor environment so that we increase exposure to the good actors.
And how do you manage it?
Well, there's lots of different ways to carry out interventions in the indoor environment. You can manage the way you ventilate or your filtration system in the indoor environment through cleaning, temperature and relative humidity through your behavior. Or there's even some new research findings showing that the way that you manage vegetation outside of your home and landscape architecture might impact the microbes that you're exposed to inside the home.
So architects are thinking about that stuff now when they design buildings?
They are. I mean, it's the very forward-leaning architects, but my colleagues at the Biology and Built Environment Center at the University of Oregon are really paving the way of this group of architects and engineers and microbiologists that are working together. And there's many other groups around the world that are thinking this way now.
Rob, how about when we build the building? Now we've designed it and we've built it. We want to build it. We start construction. Does this construction itself bring some nasty things indoors that you don't want there?
Yeah, there's some really neat recent, neat's the wrong word because it's horrible. Yeah, there's some interesting recent research showing that one of these fungi we worry about when houses get wet is black, toxic black mold, that Birgit Andersen at the Danish Technical University has shown that if you buy brand new drywall, that that mold is actually already in the drywall in many cases. And it's just hanging out there quiescent. And then when the drywall gets wet, you know, it's sort of happily grows through it like some monster of a kid's book. And so we make, Jessica made this point, well, we make all these decisions about how we build houses pretty oblivious to how each one of those decisions moves species in and out. And I think one of the great ironies of all this is that in many cases, the healthiest thing you can do in terms of your built environment is basically to make it more like the outside. You know, you open the windows, you increase flow. If the outside's polluted, that's no longer the case. But so in many ways, you know, the last years of really sealing up houses tighter and tighter, trying to kill everything, keep it clean, it took us pretty far down the wrong road. And so we're having to pause and think about where we are. Do we need to backtrack? Do we need to totally revisit what's going on here? And so there's kind of a moment of reckoning.
So Jessica, when I go into a musty old room that has not been, the windows have been closed for a while and people used it before, I'm actually walking into their microbiome because there hasn't been any circulation.
It is true. Research has shown that humans and the human microbial cloud has a great impact on the indoor microbiome. We don't know the degree to which you pick up microbes from what people have left behind, but when a person is in a room every hour, just through directly shedding their microbes or resuspending microbes in that space, they contribute more bacteria, just bacteria, per hour than the number of people that live in the state of California.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Rob Dunn and Jessica Green about the microbiome. So if I'm moving in, let's say I'm moving from my home into someone else's home, someone has been living there with a family for and dogs and whatever for a while, how long does it take for the microbiome to turn over? And then could I possibly be having a reaction to the microbes that they left behind? Rob, any?
Oh, yeah, it's a super good question. So we don't have a great answer to that. I mean, in some way, when you first move into the house, for sure you're being exposed to a whole suite of what was there before. And some of it's kind of that cloud of the last person. Some of it is, you know, the salt shaker has salt-adapted microbes. The shower head has its microbes. And each of those is sort of going to be changing at a different rate. I think the way that we often think about that is that it's kind of gross, but there's also something beautiful in as much as we're part microbial. A great part microbial, and so it's this kind of sharing with the ghosts of inhabitants past, and we do it all the time. So if you think about when we make a sourdough bread, that sourdough bread includes microbes that have colonized out of the air and from your hands, and so that bread has some of that. You know, it embodies everybody who's lived in that room, and I think there's a kind of beautiful element too, in addition to the creepy version that probably most worry about. But the short answer is we don't know.
Yeah, and the short, we are living even with the soil microbiome too. That's coming in and out of the house, and so this is like a hot topic. This is where a lot of cutting edge research is, isn't it?
We both hope so. Yeah.
Yeah.
biased audience, Lyra.
Okay. Well, we as our listeners know, this is one of our favorite subjects. We've been talking about this for probably almost 10 years now. We're bringing everybody along with us. So I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Jessica Green, professor of biology at the University of Oregon, and Rob Dunn, professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University and author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
What a great
Thank
pleasure.
You.
Did you all have a good eclipse? I was sure lucky enough to be in Casper, Wyoming for the big event, and after months, actually years of anticipation, I'm happy to say it was even more breathtaking than I had imagined. And the same was true for members of our staff who were stationed all along the path of totality. So, to cap off Eclipse Week, here's one last treat for you, the sound of a total eclipse in four time zones.
AM, Durkee, Oregon.
Wow. Totality.
11:25 AM, Midvale, Idaho.
That is unreal. Oh my gosh.
1:13 PM, Jefferson City, Missouri.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
This is weird. And it is dark.
Wow, look around.
It's gone.
Oh my gosh. That's unreal.
It's gone.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my god!
Take it off
and
look at it. It's crazy.
Oh my gosh, it's so cool.
2:38 PM, Greenville, South Carolina.
Gives me goosebumps. See how folks experienced it across the country at sciencefriday.com/totality. And this fall, Science Friday and Undiscovered are hitting the road. Yeah, we're doing live events in Wichita, Louisville, New York City, with more being announced soon. So get your tickets before they run out. Tickets at sciencefriday.com/events. sciencefriday.com/events. That's for Wichita, Louisville, and New York. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flato in New York.